ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासम् ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। नष्टप्रायेषु भद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवति उत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। कृष्णे स्वधामोपगते धर्मज्ञानादिभिः सह कलौ नष्टदृशाम् एष पुराणार्कोऽधुनोदितः। ग्रन्थराज श्रीमद्भागवतम् की जय। दिस् इस् केण्टो 5 चाप्टर् 10 एण्ड् द टेक्स्ट् इस् नम्बर् 3। वी आर् कण्टिन्यूङ्ग् द डिस्कशन् बिट्वीन् Maharaj Rahugana and Jada Bharat. I'll just read the text, which is prose.
Atha ta Ishvara vachaha sopalambham upakaranyopaya turiyat chankita manasas tam vijnapayam babhuvuhu.
When the palanquin carriers heard the threatening words of Maharaj Rahugana, they became very afraid of his punishment and began to speak to him as follows. Purport here by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. According to political science, a king sometimes tries to pacify his subordinates, sometimes chastises them, sometimes derides them, and sometimes rewards them. In this way, the king rules his subordinates. The bearers of the palanquin could understand that the king was angry and that he would chastise them.
Om Jnanatimirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah Mukam Kuroti Vachalam Pangum Langhayate Girim Yat Kripatam Aham Vande Shri Gurum Dinatarnam Vandeham Shri Guroho Shri Yutupadagamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahaganaragunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahaganalalita Shri Vishakhan Vitam Cha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivas Adi Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
In this purport, Srila Prabhupada is paraphrasing Hitopadesh and other shastras, other smritis, such as the Niti Shastra of Chanakya Pandit and others. Of course, Chanakya's Niti Shastra deals mainly with materialistic science, political science, as Prabhupada puts it here. Nonetheless, Srila Prabhupada quotes it quite a bit. Conventional wisdom, we can call it. So there are four things. They're described also in Hitopadesh that you can do. For the Brahmana, you can give him Shastric arguments. For the Kshatriya, you flatter him because he's proud. For the Vaishya, you can offer him some money, or some sort of reward, or some sort of bribe. And for the Shudra, what's left? Danda. Stick. You just beat him. As we said, this is not Srimad Bhagavatam, but this is conventional wisdom that has come down through the ages. So in this way, the king rules his subordinates. And the bearers of the palanquin, Srila Prabhupada writes in his sometimes tongue-in-cheek manner, the bearers of the palanquin could understand that the king was angry and that he would chastise them. So they were probably trembling at this point. What's this new guy doing? He's going to kill us all because of this new guy here. Let's go on to the next verse and see what happens. Navayam naradeva pramatta bhavan niyamanupathaha sadhueva vahamaha ayam adhunaiva niyukto api nadrutam vrajati nanena sahavorhum uhavayam parayama iti. They're continuing their plea to the king. Because after all, another thing Chanakya says is that you have to be very careful when dealing with kings, when dealing with women, when dealing with snakes, when dealing with fire, because these things at any moment can kill you. O Lord, please note that we are not at all negligent in discharging our duties. Sadhueva vahama. We are carrying it very nicely, they said. We have been faithfully carrying this palanquin according to your desire, but this man, who has recently been engaged to work with us, cannot walk very swiftly. Therefore, we are not able to carry the palanquin with him. This is a very interesting purport here, Srila Prabhupada writes. The other palanquin carriers were Shudras, whereas Jadavharat was not only a high caste Brahmana, but also a great devotee. Shudras do not sympathize with other living beings, but a Vaishnava cannot act like a Shudra. Whenever a Shudra and a Brahmana Vaishnava are combined, there will certainly be imbalance in the execution of duties. The Shudras were walking with the palanquin without at all caring for the ants on the ground, but Jarabharata could not act like a Shudra, and therefore difficulty arose. We know in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Ya nisha sarva bhutanam. Anybody know this verse? Ya nisha sarva bhutanam. Just now, I don't remember it either. The idea is that for the introspective sage, the way reality is perceived by someone who's on the spiritual path, basically, is very different than the way reality is perceived by someone whose only interest is in worldly pursuits, passionate things. So that always causes a problem. Krishna says, he goes so far as to say that it's like night and day. What is night for the transcendentalist is daytime for the materialists, and vice versa. So there's always a problem. Devotees necessarily have a very different goal in life or purpose in all their activities than anyone else. And that invariably runs into problems when devotees are mixing with others on a practical level. Even on a theoretical level, it's also a problem, perhaps even more so on a theoretical level. So anyway, this is the idea here. Everybody has different kind of nature, and every nature is completely appropriate for the individual. And every nature is also appropriate for society, but they don't mix. Therefore, we have, if I can use the S word, segregation. This was the traditional practice. If you go to places in South India like Srirangam, anyone been to Srirangam? Few people. You see that around first is the temple in the middle, and then immediately surrounding the temple is the Brahmana Kula, the area where the Brahmanas are living, and around that then the other castes are living. They separate. Everybody is kept separate. Because mixing together in worldly affairs, in conventional ways, this is called vyavahara, it doesn't really work so well because of the different consciousness. The world is really just a manifestation of consciousness, as Prabhupada was always tirelessly preaching. Life comes from life. Matter follows from spirit. So our external world, our external lives, our external reality, it's really just a manifestation of the consciousness that necessitated it. This whole material world is really just the necessitated by the infected consciousness of so many jivas. And Krishna has therefore made arrangement for them by creating this world. And even within this world, in relative levels, there are different stages of consciousness. There are higher and lower modes of awareness, right? The Brahmana is considered to be chiefly in the mode of goodness, sattva-guna. Nothing is ever pure, of course, so even that sattvic consciousness of the Brahmana sometimes is tinged with passion or with ignorance. And the Kshatriya is chiefly in the mode of passion. The Vaishyas are in passion with more ignorance added, and the Shudras are generally considered to be in the mode of ignorance. So, sve sve adhikare yanishta saguna parikirtata. Everybody has his own particular activities that follow from his own particular mode of consciousness, and they're all fine. They're all accommodated by Krishna, but they don't all mix together. So we have this system, therefore, that birds of a feather flock together, as they say. So this is the idea. And the Varnashram system is based on that principle. But above this social, we can say segregation, there has to be some what Krishna calls Loka Sangraha in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita. Does anybody know what Loka Sangraha, what does it mean? No, not exactly. Maybe indirectly. Loka Sangraha means social solidarity. There has to be some harmony on a civic level. Civic harmony is another way we might translate it. So how do we do that? That is why spiritual advancement is absolutely essential. It's absolutely essential. Without this system of Varnashram Dharma minus spiritual advancement, what does it become? It becomes the caste system. And even now, even though it was technically outlawed, you can say in the 1949, was it? 47, 48, something, Constitution of India, this kind of traditional social segregation that we've been discussing was outlawed. Caste segregation, you can say. Still, that system of caste system is alive and well and kicking, even in 2009 in modern India. The problem is that it has morphed from a socio-religious system based on spiritual advancement and the guidance of the gurus, sadhus, and shastras. It has morphed now into a socio-economic system, wherein all the jobs, the good jobs are, I mean, you look around in India, all the high-paying, coveted jobs are basically still taken by the Brahmanas. They're still in charge, very firmly. And even we have what in the Reagan era in the United States was called affirmative action, they have in India called caste reservations. For the lower caste persons, the idea was to give them some piece of the pie, as it were. But because the consciousness is perverted from the very outset, because the purpose is basically mundane, materialistic, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. The exploitation cannot be routed out by some artificial legislative means, or by some political agenda, or by some social activism, or by any number of other isms that Prabhupada regularly lambasts throughout his books, in order to raise awareness to this spiritual reality that we're trying to become in touch with in the human form of life. So without spiritual advancement, the Varnashram system quickly degrades into this mundane caste system that is based on basically exploiting other living beings. So we kind of see that here. There are several, two or three shudras, maybe four or five shudras are walking with Jarabharata, And because his consciousness is very different from their consciousness, therefore he's executing this work, which is actually not meant for him, in a very erratic manner. His consciousness, he's sympathizing with these tiny ants that are in the path. Krishna says, what is the beginning of sympathy? Before you can really sympathize with another person, what do you have to do? What kind of quality do you need? Compassion? Anything else? To feel their suffering. Anybody know the verse I'm thinking from chapter 6, text number 32? Atma upamyena sarvatra samam pasyati yorjana sukham va yadi va dukham sa yogi paramo mata. Krishna says, that yogi I consider to be the topmost, who's able to feel what another person feels by dint of his own experience, by his own pleasure and his own pain, he can transpose, if you will. He can feel that. He can see others. He can feel their pain. Sometimes we come across this phrase, not sometimes, quite often, throughout the scriptures, we come across this phrase, especially like in the Ishvarupanishad, for example. Sarva bhutatma bhutatma, one who has become all living beings. And our Mayavadi friends interpret that. What does it mean? According to acharyas like Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, and Gaudiya Vaishnava acharyas, it means that we can empathize with others to the extent that there's really no, we don't feel any difference. This is the basis of sympathy. This kind of understanding gives rise to compassion. And when we feel that compassion and that sympathy with the other living beings, Badri Narayan Prabhu the other day in San Diego was mentioning, he was giving a class and he was telling a story, as he often does in his uniquely entertaining manner, that there was a bug in the temple room and a devotee had to remove this bug from the temple room. So he picked up like a piece of paper or something, shoveled up this bug and took him outside and dumped him. So Badri Narayan was empathetic in his description. He was looking at the experience from the bug's perspective. The bug is peacefully going about his business, and suddenly this huge white wall comes shaving across the floor towards him. And in a terrified manner, he's trying to run for his life, doesn't know what's happening. He's shoveled hundreds of feet into the air and thrown into some alternate reality. This is his experience. But the point that I'm making is that Badri Narayan was able to see like this because he's Krishna conscious. He's able to see from, with a sympathy that Jad Bharat was also displaying here. So Jad Bharat was conscious like this. Tamal Krishna Goswami used to say, before you can become Krishna conscious, first you have to become conscious. What does it mean to become conscious? That's sattva guna. That is the brahminical qualification, to be aware. When all the gates of the body, 9 gates in our body, when they're all illumined by awareness, that is the symptom of the mode of goodness, according to chapter 14. So Jadapada was like this. And the Shudras, what are they aware of? Mainly, they are aware of their senses. Something to think about. We are also very much absorbed in sense gratification. In a materialistic society, it's very difficult to avoid that influence. But we have to work at it. Srimad Bhagavatam says that until we have actually awakened a genuine taste for hearing and chanting, we have to be very careful to cultivate the mode of goodness. And how do we cultivate the mode of goodness? By very strictly following scriptural injunctions and the samskars that are meant for gradual elevation through the cultivation of the mode of goodness and awareness that comes by following the scriptures. Now, Jadabharat is a very interesting case here because anybody, what does Jada mean? We were talking about this morning, Suresh and I. Jada. What does Jada mean? Huh? No, that's Jada. That's a different word. This is Jada. Huh? Dull. Dull Bharata. That was his name. Because that's how he's acting. Here, there's one purport I was reading. Srila Prabhupada writes, Jarabharata, despite all kinds of injustice endured because of his deaf and dumb display, remained silent by the strength of his spiritual advancement. So he was putting on a deaf and dumb display. We know, if we were listening to the chapter summary a few days ago, that Jarabharata was previously King Bharata, the king of the entire world, the highest king in the whole world, and he became a deer. And because he had such a fall down, he was conscious and very careful not to let anything happen again, and therefore he kept himself totally secluded from the whole society by putting on this act that he was like deaf and dumb and retarded. Consequently, people used to mistreat him. They used to, it's described his, after his parents left this world, and his stepbrothers and stepparents would mistreat him, and they would give him rotten food to eat, and they would make him do all the tasks that nobody else wanted to do. This is the kind of treatment we can expect if we want to become Krishna conscious in this world. In fact, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, those who are blessed by God find their path beset with thorns. But in particular, people in this world are not particularly well motivated all the time, and they will mistreat us, especially when we're surrounded by those who are now surrounding Jarabharata. He was Krishna conscious. He was thinking with compassion of the ants. He didn't want to kill them, artificially arrest their natural spiritual evolution. But those whose vision is in the mode of passion and ignorance, they can't relate. And they see that the devotee is causing a problem. This is what happens. The devotee is trying to solve a problem, but persons in the mode of ignorance think that the devotee is causing a problem. This is always what happens. It's always a difficulty to try and be Krishna conscious in this world, because most of the people in this world are not even sattvic, what to speak of Krishna conscious. Most people are totally submerged in the modes of passion and ignorance. In a few purports, Srila Prabhupada will discuss this at length. He is discussing how the king in particular was in the mode of passion. What is the symptom of the mode of passion? How do we view other living beings with different kinds of bodies in the mode of passion? Anybody remember? Huh? Envy and friends and enemies. I'm thinking in particular, and I think, believe it's chapter 14 again, maybe 13, Krishna says that we see a different kind of living entity according to a different kind of material body, right? So there's a little tiny living entity in an ant body, and because the body is so small and insignificant, therefore we assume that the spiritual soul within it is also small and insignificant. This is passionate mentality that the king had. When we're impelled by material desires, when we're impelled by passion, this is the kind of consciousness that results. And we consequently will mistreat other living beings or harm them. We don't mind stepping on other people's toes or other living creatures' toes in order to get what we want. That's what passion does to us. Nunam pramatta kurute vikarnama yad indriya pritaya aprinoti. Anybody know the rest of it? Asanna viklesha da asadeha. This is who is teaching this? Rishabhadev, the ancestor of Bharata Maharaja, about whom we're speaking. He says, when we are, how should we say? Yeah, pramatta. When we are caught, entangled in this bodily concept of life, we become mad. And we don't care for any sinful activity in order to get what we feel we need. It's only natural. Self-preservation is the first law of nature, they say. If you believe that you are the body, you're going to have to do what the body is ordering, because you believe it's in your self-interest. This is called maya, or moha, rather, illusion. So in the human form of life, we were saying, we have these samskaras that should bring us to the mode of goodness, but that's not enough. And once in the mode of goodness, we have to cultivate Krishna consciousness. Now, Jarabharata was an interesting case because He was putting on this act as if he was jada, as if he was in the mode of ignorance, but actually he was beyond the mode of goodness even. He was absolutely self-realized at this point. And therefore, he didn't bother with all these samskars that are meant for the gradual purification of so many other living beings. We may not be able to imitate Jadaparatha in that way, although we can see the general tenor of Srila Prabhupada's purports here and elsewhere is definitely focusing on the paramartha, the ultimate goal of life, or what the Srimad Bhagavatam first canto calls parodharma. Parodharma means that dharma which is shared by all living entities. Because each of us has an individual dharma that we have to fulfill. There are dharmas for women, there are dharmas for husbands, there are dharmas for sannyasis, there are dharmas for brahmacharis, there are dharmas for the vaishyas. Everybody has his own particular dharma. And there are dharmas for different conditions. There's emergency dharma, there's normal dharma, all different kinds of dharmas. And they're all different. Nobody shares all the same set of dharmas. They're always different. They have to be. Because they are relative to the conditioning that is snaring us in Maya. But there is one dharma that we all have in common, and that is bhakti. Savai pungsam, anybody know? Paro dharma yato bhakti rad hokshaje. Ahaituki apritehata. Yayatma supasidati. That thing which will ultimately please the self, which is really in our real interest, that is this whatever it takes to awaken this taste for worship and love of Adhokshaja, the Supreme Transcendental Lord. That's called Bhakti Yoga. So this is the supreme goal of life. And Srila Prabhupada is always emphasizing this primary necessity, because it's very easy to lose sight of the goal. This is why, throughout his books, Srila Prabhupada again and again quotes very basic philosophical ideas, such as we are not the body, we are entangled by karma, and how that's working. These very basic things, they have to be repeated again and again and again, because although they are the most basic things, they're also the most easy to forget. And sometimes people get lost in the minutiae of karmic regulations, samskars, and rituals, and various other upadharmas. It's called sub-religious principles. I was talking to Kavi Chandra Maharaj the other day in Tijuana, and he was saying that he was talking with Pradyumna, I think it was, about Hari Bhakti Vilas by Gopal Bhatta Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, and how Srila Prabhupada in general was not very much pushing on Hari Bhakti Vilas. And so they were talking about why that is so. And Pradyumna gave his opinion that it's probably because it tends to engender this mentality of more is better. More regulations, more rituals, more complication, more sophistication on a karmic level that's not purely spiritual. And in the same way, that's in the realm of karma, and in the same way in the realm of jnana, also, even though jnana or Brahman realization, identity with Brahman, is the substrate, it's the foundation of pure bhakti, but we have to be very, very careful, Srila Prabhupada says, because it is the last snare of Maya. Both of them are actually essential for our spiritual advancement. Karmic regulations are essential in the form of pious activity. How do we know this? Where does Krishna say so? Very good. Very good. Yesham tvantagatam papam jananam purnya karnamanam te dvandvamoha nirmukta bharante mam drithavrataha. Those who are fixed in piety and whose sinful reactions have been eradicated, they can persevere in pure bhakti, Krishna says. Similarly, jnana is also necessary for bhakti. And where does Krishna say that? Chapter 18. Brahma-bhuta prasannatmana shochati na kankshati samasarveshu bhuteshu madbhakti labhate. We will get pure bhakti when we are on this Brahman level in which there's no more hankering, there's no more lamenting, and we're completely set. We see all living beings equally. This was Bharat Maharaj. This is Jad Bharat's mentality. He was able to see the ants equally, equal to himself. Atmavan manyate jagat. This is the idea. So karma and jnana are both necessary, but they're both very dangerous at the same time. So we have to recognize that. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada, throughout his books, primatizes the ultimate goal, the very highest thing. Om tad vishno paramam param sada pasyanti surayah divi vachakshuratatam tad viprasu vipanyavo jagravagum sasamindhate vishnor yat padamam padam. Those who are godly, they always look to the highest thing, paramam padam. They don't lose sight of that. Or, as the Upanishad states, it's like shooting an arrow, archery, shooting an arrow towards a target. The soul is the arrow, and the intelligence is this bow, and we're shooting it very carefully. And when we hit the target, then we can hit the target. If we keep our mind on the lakshya, lakshya means the goal, or the gati, the supreme aim. So these are a few things we can think about in regards to text 3 and 4. There's much more to this story. It's a very, very rich narration. There's so many lessons to be learned here. But I'll stop here in case anybody has any questions or comments. Yes, Prabhu. Yep. This is a very good point. Good question. He's asking that we've been warning about how dangerous both karma and jnana are for cultivation of bhakti. And although they're necessary for the cultivation of bhakti, it's also necessary to give them up at a certain point in favor of pure bhakti, devoid of karma and jnana. So he's asking, what kind of karma and jnana are we discouraging here? Obviously, we're discouraging that karma which has some material fruitive motive, or even the tendency to become lost in rules and regulations, which Rupa Goswami calls niyamagraha, even in dealing with transcendental activities or scripturally enjoined activities relating to pure devotional service. Sometimes someone becomes too much absorbed in rules and regulations. That's how I interpret Prajuna Prabhu's statement that, you know, the mentality of more is better. And it seems that Srila Prabhupada was very careful to not let that mentality grow too much in his movement, because he had seen in India that, you know, how many ways that this can manifest. So although we discourage both karma and jnana, the fact is that we are interested Dibya Gyan Hride Prakashito. We're singing every day to our spiritual master that part of his glory is the fact that he awakens transcendental gyan within our hearts. So gyan also has its purpose in bhakti, and karma obviously also has its purpose in bhakti. Karma. Janma karma chame divyam, Krishna says. So we're interested in divya karma and in divya gyan. This is the point. Although bhakti rejects both karma and jnana, bhakti is composed of nothing but karma and jnana. That's the irony. This is called achintya bheda bheda. And it's like this with everything. Wherever you find an identity, we will also find a difference. And you cannot put them together logically all the time. Is that okay? Yes, Prabhupati Prabhu.
Prabhu, you mentioned at one point in your class how Jad Bharat was sympathetic to the ants. And you used the phrase, he didn't want to check their progressive spiritual march or something to that effect.
Spiritual evolution.
Spiritual evolution, yeah. And Prabhupada actually touched upon that in the purport of yesterday's verse in an interesting way. He mentioned how every living entity, is, you know, they're in a particular body and they have to serve a certain amount of time in that body. You know, say those ants, they're destined, they have to serve a certain amount of time in that ant body before they can move on to the next higher species, which happens automatically and mechanically. And if somebody interferes with that, then they're disturbing that living entity's progress.
That was text two.
Sorry?
Text two purport.
Yeah, text two purport, right. So I was thinking about that, and I was asking some devotees about that the other day after the class, and it just didn't seem fair to me. It didn't seem just. My understanding, and it could be a misunderstanding of the law of karma, was that it was a perfect system of universal justice. There's no such thing as an innocent victim. And it was sounding to me that these ants or fish or whatever, you know, whatever living entity we're referring to, some living entities are being put at a disadvantage here, and they're like innocent victims. It didn't sound just, you know? So that was my question. Maybe you could say something about that.
Let me see if I understand your doubt. Is that if the system is perfect, then how come they can be killed inadvertently like this?
Yeah, it's no fault of theirs. It's no fault of those ants that these guys are stepping on them and killing them. They're just doing their ant thing.
Okay, this is a good question. And why is it necessary that we spend a certain time, a certain sentence, if you will, in a particular body? You know, this is where karma gets very complicated, and it's very difficult to understand the intricacies of this system. Krishna says as well in chapter 3. Or is it 5? I don't remember. But by spending a particular time allotted in a particular body, somehow or other we are purified of whatever past karmas we have, whatever karmic film has accumulated within our minds, and produce a particular consciousness that we're trying to transcend. The natural system of transmigration somehow or other affects this as a matter of course, to some degree. It can never erase the tendency for materialistic activity, but to some degree it can erase the effects of one's previous activities. That much I can say in the abstract. Beyond that, I wouldn't want to comment because this, like I said, this is very... It's an intricate science, and actually those who are scientific by nature should really specialize in this sort of knowledge because it's lacking in the universities. Is that satisfying? Prabhuji. I'd like to say something more in that, but you know, this is the area of specialty of the Karmakandiya pundits. Those whose whole life is absorbed in, say, astrology and karma mimamsa, and they get into these kinds of questions in great detail, they would be more able to really address it in detail in terms of the mechanics.
So, Prabhu, just like a comment, that thank you very much for your beautiful explanation. In regards to that, following that question, and also, my understanding is that, isn't it that the intention that we as devotees, that's what I thought, the intention immediately goes to the root and the basis of things. So, like in the Niti Shastra.
Intention, you
intention.
Said? Intention. Intention goes to?
You as a living entity towards another living entity. Mm-hmm. Like in the Niti Shastra, you were mentioning quoting Chanakrapandi. In one verse, he says, Atmavan Sarva Bhutanam. One should feel other living entities.
Now, you're saying intention or attention?
Intention, and you can say also attention, both intention towards somebody else. In other words, yes, there's an ant, there's a cockroach, there's a bee, there's a bird, there's a tree, there's any living being that counts. And they have a place in this universe for some reason. So you as a devotee, you know what you're supposed to be doing or what not supposed to be not doing. So with that knowledge, with that shastra, chakshu that Prabhupada gives us, or this very virtuous, you refrain from impeding somebody else's progress in spiritual life. Mm. So that's like the beginning. And just like the whole Buddhist philosophy is based in compassion, of course, they explain it in a different way. So the same thing. So that's just my comment.
Vada dukkha dukhi, that is the manifestation of one a devotee's empathy.
Yeah, so we pay attention to all the surroundings here, this whole creation, because everything is aham sarvasa prabhu, but, you know, Krishna is both.
Sattvic awareness.
If you see Krishna in every living being, and Krishna in everything, and Krishna without everything, outside and inside, how could you cause trouble, difficulties, anxieties to other living beings?
Tatrako moha kashoka.
Yeah, Ishopanishad.
So I think that's a comment rather than a question, right? Okay. Karuna Dharani?
Thank you for giving a very nice Srimad Bhagavatam class. We don't see women going around in human society killing people any more than men do. So when you gave the shloka of Chanaka Pandit about the king and the snake and the woman, that they could kill you, was that literally or figuratively, or is it killing the soul, or what's the death there?
Now I'm on the hot seat. Yeah, I tried to qualify that by saying that this is not Srimad Bhagavatam teaching. This is conventional wisdom. And it's also political science, but, you know, this is the idea.
But if you say it, I guess it needs more explanation, because when you're in a woman's body and you hear that, you kind of like, whoa, what?
Yeah,
it's a little shocking.
Yeah, it does seem a little unfair to those of us who are socialized in with the concept that all living beings are, you know, that all bodies, I should say, are equal and everybody has, you know, the same voice and everything. This is not the traditional wisdom. So it's kind of like when we hear Srila Prabhupada lambasting modern science, those of us who are schooled and very attached to the concepts that we receive from modern science, we kind of jolt a little bit. It's not easy. But in addition to that, we should note that this is not transcendental either. It's not transcendental teaching. This is mundane, conventional wisdom, as I said. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Arjita Prabhu?
Yeah, this point comes up a lot, and I always answer by one incident in the process, actually, with another one, which came to the prophet and complained that, you know, the boys, you know, from another, you know, was teasing or classically, and this and that. And the prophet said, if you continue to think of yourself as a woman, how are you going to make progress? So this is the same. In that same verse, trying to find the pre-cut policies, obviously, they're male policies, so they don't get upset. You know, why are you preaching a politician? I'm not a politician. Okay, I'm open to the eyes. You know, but if you can't keep identifying yourself in any particular group on this planet, you'll never be happy. If somebody's always going to say something against that group, whether it's black or white or male or female or politician or whatever. So the real idea is to get above that, transcend that. Stop thinking of yourself as a woman.
Yeah.
Stop thinking of yourself as black or white or male or female, and you won't be upset about anything.
These are the excellent points that this is why I said Srila Prabhupada is constantly emphasizing this transcendental perspective and constantly repeating these basic ideas that we are not this body, because basically, whether you like it or not, this material world is in fact based on mutual exploitation. That's just the way it is. That's not Krishna's intention. It's not the teaching of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not Vaishnava tradition, but it is the reality. Everybody in this world, black or white, young or old, male, female, rich or poor, they're all exploiting each other, and that's never going to change. And there's no political, economic, social, or other kind of agenda that's really going to change that. It's not possible. But if we can recognize that we are actually not this body, and that therefore these things do not really affect us, then we can become freed from it. But that's the only way.
I guess one further question is, I don't think he really meant in Chanakapanda, I don't think he really meant that women were going around killing men, because even in his times, I don't think that was the case so much. So, I mean, maybe he meant killing the soul, like that the sangha of female association is not good for the spiritual advancement. Maybe he was referring to that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say... I mean, sometimes male association is not good for a woman's spiritual advancement. It's relative also, you know. I would say it's more or less figurative, and the general sense that I get from it is that one should be very cautious. One should not trust a person who is on the materialistic platform, no matter what their station. We say women and politicians should not be trusted. This is it's not an absolute truth by any means, but as I said, this is conventional wisdom. It's relevant in its own sphere for what that's worth, and it's not worth much.
Yeah.
Anything else, or we'll end now? One more in the back. As the spiritual soul has volition and always wants to act, so that moksha cannot last forever unless it has a practical application. The only possible application on the liberated platform is bhakti. Nothing else is possible on the liberated platform, because the only other kind of option we have is material. And if we act in a material realm, then we re-enter the realm of karma. Is that clear?
If I can understand it properly, say first is karma, and then next is jnana, and the ultimate is bhakti.
Yes. Good. Okay. And we see that this is the progression in the conversation that Krishna teaches Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. He begins with karma, do your duty, and then he gets into jnana later on and ultimately culminates in bhakti.
Thank you.
Okay, we should stop now. It's getting late. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.